Welcome to the Good Growing Podcast. I am Chris Enroth, horticulture educator with the University of Illinois Extension, coming at you from Macomb, Illinois, and we have got a great show for you today. We are going to be talking about perennial vegetables. Oh my goodness, you put them in the ground once and they come back year after year. That sounds too good to be true. And you know, I am not doing this by myself. I am joined, as always, every single week by horticulture educator Ken Johnson in Jacksonville. Hey, Ken.
Hello, Chris. Did you get your seeds started yet? Going back to last week.
Yeah, I did. I got my a flat of cool season seeds started. I got the warm season flat ready. But I have not gotten it planted yet, but I got the cool season stuff going, and I'm only like, what, 2 weeks behind on that one. So I'm doing better than most years. How about yourself?
That's good. Yep, we've got stuff coming up. I've some tomatoes started. Started my purple tomatoes. Do not have any germination yet.
Hey,
I'm a little worried.
I'm a little nervous about those too. In addition to the vegetable stuff too, I also have like 15 flats of ginger. I also have going, which are using up all of my heat mats. And so that's why I delayed my warm season stuff, because I plan on taking one of those heat mats for my warm season stuff, which is going to have the purple tomato in it. Let me know if you get germination or not, because I would love to know if it's going to be worth the heartache if they don't germinate.
Yeah, or you're going to have to try yours so I can get some plants from you.
There you go. For folks who don't know what we're talking about with this purple tomato, they released a GMO tomato on the market for home growers, that they took the genes of a snapdragon and they crossed that with tomatoes so that it is purple skinned and fleshed throughout. And yeah, they're really just trying to bump up some of those, what are they, anthocyanin pigments in there, with some extra nutritional value.
And going back to ginger, I need to get mine started. It's all cut, ready to go. I just need to get the mix, potting mix, and get those on heat mats.
Well, I learned a whole lot about ginger the other day. A colleague of ours shared a handout from the University of Florida. And, you know, Ken, those Florida people, they're awfully smart. Do you know anyone that went to school there?
No.
Besides yourself? Oh, they had a great handout about sprouting ginger and turmeric and galangal. And I think I've been doing it wrong since like 2017. So, you know, you learn something new every year, right? When you're growing something.
I guess I need to read that article then.
Check it out, because I have been putting my ginger in like flats as they do this, like arranged and sort of like a puzzle piece style, trying to fit them all together. And then I cover it with potting soil. And they say, don't cover with potting soil. You have to keep the potting soil that they're resting on slightly damp, but then you cover that with like a humidity dome, which keeps the humidity up, but you're not constantly, you don't have water up against that rhizome, which might lead to rot. And so maybe that will cut out some potting soil material that you would otherwise be using. So worth a try. Too late for me, but yeah. If you need a couple humidity domes, I have some.
I guess, good thing I procrastinated this year.
There you go. There you go. Give it a try. So I have a video online that I give the opposite information. So I don't know how you change YouTube videos other than get rid of them. Anyway, Ken, well, let's dive right into this topic of perennial vegetables. And I think as we define this, I mean, before the show started, we're like talking about, you know, what do we want to discuss? And I said, oh, strawberries. And you said, Chris, that's not a vegetable. A strawberry is a fruit. So we do have a lineup of vegetables for you today, like specific to a vegetable, not a fruit. And we're going to kick it off with asparagus. So, Ken, what's your favorite part about asparagus?
I don't know. I like the way it tastes. I guess.
I do love to eat asparagus, and then I become very self-conscious afterwards when you're in the bathroom. So, because it makes your pee smell funny.
Yeah, and as an aside for that, so not everybody pee stinks. So, what is it? So it's got aspergillic acid, which is broken down into sulfur-containing compounds by your body. It's what causes your urine to smell unique after eating it. If it doesn't smell after eating asparagus, maybe for part of the 40% of the population that can't smell. So I guess everybody does, but some people can't smell it. So
consider yourself lucky. And also, did you know that when they are going through the astronaut selection program, they like to select astronauts that can't smell stuff like that, because they know they're going to be cooped up in this little space in space. And so they want people up there who like aren't sensitive to body odor or asparagus pee, things like that. So just an aside, any aspiring astronauts out there.
You know, it'd be easier just not to give them asparagus, but.
No, they have to eat it. They have to eat it. That's a requirement for astronauts. Oh my goodness. Anyway, well, Ken, I've grown asparagus. I kind of grew up like my parents had an asparagus patch in the garden. We grow it here at our food donation garden in Macomb. I don't grow it currently at home. Do you have any asparagus at your house?
We do not. We talked about growing it this year, but I don't know if we ever actually added it to our cart because it hasn't shown up yet. So, and that's one of those things that probably won't come till a little bit later, because we would traditionally, you're going to buy the crowns or the roots. You can buy seed, but that's going to add another year or two before you can harvest. So typically people are going to buy the crowns or like the 1-2-year-old plants that you're going to plant that will speed the process up for your asparagus.
And they all like, you also want the crowns though, because they can select for male and female, right? Like with seed, there's probably a little bit of genetic mystery there. Like, oh, what are you going to get? So we want males, correct? Because in terms of seed production.
Yeah. And I'm not sure how long it takes to figure out if it's male or female, if you can tell that in the first year or not. I know a lot of the newer cultivars are more male or male cultivars that you're buying stuff. But yeah, if you have the female, they're sending a lot of energy into flower, seed and fruit production, which is going to kind of sap some of that energy that could otherwise go into producing spears. So that's why typically, again, if you can, if you're looking for one, get one that's got males, predominantly male plants at the very least, because they're putting all their energy into spear formation. All that's being stored in the roots. They're not, say, wasting isn't the right word, but I guess from the human perspective, they're not wasting any energy on flower, fruit and seed production.
Yeah. Well, so Ken, if we go with purchasing live plants or the crowns, what type of prep are we expecting for an asparagus patch? Because as a perennial vegetable, this is not like a regular garden bed that can be turned over each year. I mean, you put asparagus there and, well, that's where it's going to be for probably the duration of you ever owning that garden at that home. So give us some site preparation tips to get started.
Yeah, this will go for not only asparagus, but basically any of your perennial vegetables. Site prep is going to be important. So it's probably not something you necessarily want to go out and just buy on a whim. You may want to do a little planning. For the most part, all of these are going to want, you know, well-drained soil. And most of our, pretty much all of our fruits and vegetables, they do not like having wet feet. So having an area that's going to be well-drained, probably maybe wanting to incorporate some organic matter that year before. So again, you have those nice fertile soils. They're going to want full sun. So again, make sure that you've got a full sun, and you know, this could be in the ground for 15 plus years. So look at the surrounding landscaping. Do you have trees nearby? Are those trees mature? Are they still growing? Is that going to cast shade eventually? So keep those, some of the things in mind, not just for this year, but 10, 15 plus years down the line. What is that landscape going to potentially look like when you're citing these things? So those are some important things. I think a lot of times we overlook, not only for perennial vegetables, but anything like, you know, or strawberries or you know, blueberries is a good example of people not prepping the soil beforehand, and they don't have the right acidity and stuff like that.
Yeah. We get the phone call of, hey, I got blueberries in hand and a shovel in the other. Now what? I'm like, well, there's a little bit of planning that needs to go in before you get that plant in the ground. So I guess in terms of prepping a perennial vegetable bed, a lot of what I hear about is amending the soil to a lot of them say amend the soil to be rich, which a lot of times I'm assuming it's more like amend it with some type of organic matter, whether it's compost or like rotted leaves, something to mix into the soil to add organic matter to that site, maybe a few months before you even plant it. And I know at least with our asparagus patch at the extension office here, we used horse manure. Now, horse manure, it's a great manure. It's got good nitrogen contents, and it can provide a good vegetative boost to asparagus, you know. However, manure, and specifically horse manure, has a lot of weed seeds, and that's something we really had to battle quite a bit over the years when we introduced manure into our soil. And so I'd probably caution folks reading that information about enriching your soil, adding amendments to it. One, do that soil test beforehand. See if you really even need to do that. And then two, maybe skip some of the animal-based manures. You know, chicken and rabbit, they're a little bit less weedy, but that horse manure, it's given me a really bad taste in my mouth and calluses on my fingers from pulling all the weeds in that asparagus patch.
Yeah, and if you are going to be eating manure, make sure as well it's fully composted. Mm-hmm. Now, that's going to eliminate every seed in there, but that'll go a long way in reducing some of that too.
Oh, that's true. I think maybe in this case, the horses might have still been pooping on the trailer as they were shipping it over to us. So, it was composted, but the worst weed that we got out of it was poison hemlock, which horses can't eat. You know, they're not processing that. So that is probably a weed seed that blew in onto their pile of their stall, mm-hmm. when they're mucking the stall and cleaning it out. So that probably just blew in, but boy, it was just full of poison hemlock and all other kinds of weed seeds.
So then as far as, you know, so you've got your soil prep. So again, we're probably ideally doing this in the fall, the year before, if not sooner, because typically we're getting these, we're planting them as soon as you can work the soil. So this time of year, been March to mid-April is a lot of times in Illinois anyway, central Illinois, when we'd be planting these. So again, we're getting those crowns, those roots. Typically what we're going to do is we're going to dig a trench about 6 inches deep, 12 to 18 inches wide, or make a little kind of a mound in the middle of that trench. We're going to lay the roots on there, let them drape over that, and space those roots, those crowns, 9 to 12 inches apart. And then we'll cover those crowns. We're not going to completely fill that trench. We're going to cover it, let them grow. And as they start growing, we're going to fill it in, kind of like what you would with like killing potatoes as they start poking up. Cover it until you kind of get that trench fully grown or fully covered. And then, you know, you're going to let them grow. That first year, they'll die back in the fall. You can clean that up. A lot of times it's a good idea to clean that foliage up because you've got some pests and diseases that could potentially overwinter on that. Clean that up. Second year, they'll emerge. And then there's some, I don't know if debate's the right word, but do you see different recommendations on when you can start harvesting? Some places say you can start harvesting that second year if you're doing going by crowns, and you can harvest for maybe week or two, and then you let everything go again, let them grow. They'll produce the ferns, which are the leaves. They have these really fine, kind of like asparagus fern leaves, and you want them to do that. You know, they're producing, they're photosynthesizing, producing all this energy, storing that in the roots. So similar to your spring bulbs, you want to leave those, that foliage on there as long as possible so they can produce all this energy and all that food that they're going to store. So the second year, maybe a week or two, then let them grow. Third year, up to 4 weeks harvest and then let them go. And then that fourth year, you can go full harvest, go through May or June, as long as the spears are about 3/8 of an inch or larger in diameter. Mm-hmm. It's one. Some places say don't even start harvesting till the third year. Some people skip the second year, let them grow, and start that shorter harvest the third year. So it's kind of all over the place, but don't go too crazy too quick. We want them to be able to, you know, put in those reserves to the roots, let them grow bigger. So you get that, again, if you're in this for the long haul, again, delay that gratification a little bit and you'll get your harvest for 10, 15 plus years.
And, you know, can I say, you got to let them harvest a little bit that second year. So it's a little bit of a what is to come here if that asparagus patch really gets off the ground and running. And, you know, when we planted ours out here, you know, we really made sure to adhere to, if it was a spear coming up that was really flimsy looking, that was about maybe the size of a number two pencil in width or less, we really tried to leave that alone. But if we saw like a kind of a wider spear emerging from the ground, we would pop that off. The other thing about asparagus, a lot of people think, oh yeah, well, I gotta, you know, what's the point of firing up the oven for one little spear of asparagus? Do you know you can eat them raw, and they are just as good raw, especially when you harvest them fresh out of the garden. I remember doing that. I did a farmer visit here with Extension many years ago. And this farmer, he actually lets his asparagus grow in a big pasture, which not only has asparagus, but also has strawberries. And it's just like this kind of wild and woolly ground cover. And he said, you know, reach down, pluck off that asparagus spear and take a bite. And I did. And it was like the best asparagus I've ever had before. And I think it was just plain old, you know, a regular run of the mill variety. So, but it's, you can just that second year, just break off a spear, take a bite. It's a good treat.
So when you harvest, do you cut or break the spears?
Oh, I definitely break. Cause right is, so when you go to the grocery store, they're all cut. Now, I heard that they do that because asparagus is sold by the weight, and they get a little bit of extra weight when they take that sharp knife and cut right below the soil line right there, and they get a little bit of that woody part there. It's a little bit heavier, so they can charge you a little bit more. So I always break. What do you do? What should we do, Ken?
I think you can do either. I'd say if you're going to cut, what you're supposed to do, 45-degree angle, kind of at mm-hmm. a little bit of that soil line. I think if you do that, you run the risk of nicking the tops of any others that may be coming up.
Yep.
Which could affect the development. So at home, you're probably better off just snapping, but you can cut too.
Yeah, you can cut too. Yeah. I mean, it's probably easier to cut. Yeah. Yeah. Do whatever you want. I'm just trying to share a little bit of market insight into how asparagus is sold. So yeah. All right. So we got through like site prep and how we dig the trench, and we slowly cover that trench up as we want those crowns to grow and develop. Now, I had mentioned about I had some really bad weed problems and really weed issues. This is the same across the board for what we're talking about today. When it comes to weed control in a perennial vegetable patch, I think it's a lot more difficult in some cases of controlling those weeds, because unlike your annual vegetables, which you can flip those beds over and you can do weed control stuff, again, you've got to go in pretty much by hand and pull stuff in these perennial vegetable patches. Now, for us, we really utilize mulch as a tool for keeping weeds down, and it worked fairly decently. Another thing we also did is we planted in and amongst our asparagus, we planted zinnia, and we just got like, we got these tall asparagus, and then we got this patch of zinnia on the border. I think it did a pretty good job of shading out the soil and keeping weeds down a little bit. But Ken, you got any other tips besides mulch and the random idea of zinnia being thrown on the ground?
I think with asparagus, you can do some some real shallow cultivation in the spring before they start coming up. Once they start coming up, you start cultivating, you hit those spears, and you're just going to mess up that Grosella. If you need to, shallow cultivation in the spring before they start popping, and then mulching to keep all that stuff down. It's another reason why you don't necessarily want to have female plants, because they drop those seeds germinate, and they become weeds themselves. You could end up with having, you could have too much asparagus, and then you get all these seedlings coming up. So another reason to try to avoid those female plants where you're going to be picking seedlings out. And I think a lot of times, I don't know how much it is anymore, but you hear about people adding salt to their asparagus patch to help control weeds. And so asparagus does have a higher salt tolerance than a lot of plants, so it can tolerate some of that salt in the soil. But it's not, it doesn't have an unlimited tolerance. So if you're constantly doing that, you do run the risk of affecting your asparagus. And adding salt to your soil can cause problems. It can cause it to deflocculate and cause issues with water infiltration and all this kind of other stuff. So probably not a good idea. Would not recommend doing salt. There's a reason the Romans salted the earth and Carthage and all those places.
They was trying to starve people to death. So yeah, that's why they did it. So don't do it to your vegetable garden if you want to eat from it. So yeah, avoid the salt. Well, one last thing that comes to my mind with asparagus, and that is, I love it in the fall because the fronds develop. You get these ferny, kind of wispy, fine textured foliage, and then it turns yellow, like a bright yellow. So I think asparagus has almost an ornamental appeal, especially in that fall color time frame. And I have a picture of one of those I can pop up right here. Just this really interesting yellow fall color with our asparagus patch. So that comes to mind, but I think there might be other pests and things to consider, like asparagus beetle. And I guess that's why maybe we do our cleanup in the late fall as opposed to spring. Is that right, Ken?
Yeah. So asparagus beetles will feed on the spears and stuff, and cause them to be crooked, things like that. Feed on the ferns and kind of reduce that leaf area and stuff. So that's one thing. Cleaning that up, removing that overwintering area can be helpful. And the larvae, I think, are kind of what's doing a lot of the damage. They're kind of like caterpillars, almost kind of slug-like beetle larvae on there. Another big problem could be asparagus rust. So you'll get kind of discolored, rusty spots on the plants as well. That's another reason for cleanup if you've got that rust. And there are some varieties that are resistant to rust, so that can be something. Obviously, if you've never grown it, you don't know if you're going to have issues with it. But if you do have issues, or you have had issues, maybe looking at a resistant cultivar for rust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in terms of cultivar selection, I know there was a story that was put out that was at the Jersey series was going to be discontinued. And that's a pretty popular asparagus variety cultivar. But that was in 2021. But as you mentioned, Ken, you can still go online and find other people selling that. So we're not quite sure how that is, if they are actually doing so legally. And why is there still Jersey out there?
There's a lot of places selling it. So.
Yeah. If anybody knows the story behind the Jersey series for asparagus, let us know in the comments.
Yeah, but with asparagus, I think you typically think of the white, or not the white, the green asparagus, mm-hmm. but there's also purple cultivars. And that's one that we've talked about growing. It was like Purple Passion would be one that's purple. I think there's some newer ones as well. I've heard mention of like a pink one. I've never seen that, but I've seen it mentioned elsewhere that there's pink. So I don't, admittedly, I haven't looked extensively for it, but rumor has it.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also white asparagus, which isn't a cultivar. That's actually been blanched. So they'll cover those spears. If you're doing it at home, you can get a cardboard box or bucket, put that over there, and that'll blanch it, cause them to be white instead of green. So if you like white asparagus, which I think is more popular in Europe than it is in the U.S. But yep. If you want the white stuff, it's not a cultivar you buy. You blanch that, cover it to prevent sun getting to it, kind of like you would do with like cauliflower. If you want that white head, you wrap the leaves around it so it doesn't, if it gets exposed to the sun, the cauliflower will turn kind of yellow. So asparagus, you cover it to keep it white.
Well, I mean, I did poke my head out earlier today and I did not see any asparagus popping up in the garden yet, but maybe I probably need to move some leaves around. I bet that it's already started, but I can definitely assure you our next perennial vegetable is up, at least at my house, and that is a rhubarb. I have actually a very healthy rhubarb plant. When people come over, the folks will look at this plant that's like, it looks like something out of the Jurassic period. And it's the plant is massive. I didn't know rhubarb leaves got that big, but they're probably like, some leaves are maybe like 2.5 feet long. They're huge. And so anyway, I have a very healthy rhubarb. And in terms of site prep for that, you know, I did similar things. We amended it, the planting area, with compost. And then I planted it, tried to make the soil as rich as I could in that area. The rhubarb seems to respond really well. We mulch with shredded leaves, which break down and again, add more organic matter to that site. So I think I got a rhubarb on steroids. So I'm pretty stoked about that. And it's already like 1.5 feet tall and it's March 26th, which is wild. I'm afraid to eat it though. So I'm not going to eat it right now.
Yeah. We want to talk about that now or wait.
Maybe we'll wait. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about growing it first. Yeah, before we talk about how it could kill you or make you sick.
About kill, but yes.
Yeah, make you sick, make you hurt real bad. So, Ken, do you have any rhubarb in your neck of the woods?
Nope. It's another one I'm trying to work on my wife. Mm-hmm. It's a plant, mainly so that people ask me questions about it. I have some experience with what I'm talking about.
Well, I'll say from my experience, I do almost nothing to this plant except for mulch. Like I'll add some shred leaves to it in the fall and that's about all I ever have to do. And then, you know, I chop off the foliage in the winter sometime and clean it up. And it is a pretty easy plant to care for. And so when we are growing rhubarb and harvesting it, we're actually harvesting not the leaf itself, but the actual like the stalk, the petiole that the leaf grows on. And that's the actual part that we use from the plant. And I would say maybe the only problems we ever had, like I know Japanese beetles will go after the leaves a little bit, but rhubarb, it might grow waist high at its tallest. You know, I'd say more like knee high. So it's really easy to just walk around it and pick off the Japanese beetles and throw them in soapy water or something. So it's not a difficult plant to control pests. So I think so long as you have it mulched, you have amended the soil, you're going to be fairly successful with your rhubarb. And the variety that we grow, I think it is Victoria. I think that's what it was. We know the name of it. So yeah, I think it's a Victoria rhubarb. The stems are mostly green. They're slightly reddish, but I think for the most part, they're green. And I think the flavor is nothing to write home about, which is why you have to add tons of sugar when you're making rhubarb pie or jam or jelly to make it taste good. It just tastes like lettuce. So, yeah.
And there's some of them have red, right? Red petioles.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Ours is a reddish tinge, maybe more pink, but mostly green.
Yeah. So then other one question I've got a couple of times about them is when they start putting out flowers, what do you, mm-hmm. if you had those, do you leave them? Do you cut them?
Yeah. So the very first year we put it in the ground, we got flowers and I cut it off and the flower stalk, it's pretty massive too. It's this hollow inside tube almost. And you cut it off. So that's what I've been doing. Every time I see a flower stalk begin to pop up is I pop it off and I don't let it flower. I don't know if that's best practice, but that's what I'm going to do, because I want the plant to focus more on root establishment and leaf development as opposed to flower and seed production.
Everything I've spread is, yeah. You want them to bloom, that's fine. But yeah, you're sacrificing some of that. You know, that, just like asparagus, that energy is going into seed formation, flower formation, instead of into the roots to grow more leaves and stuff, which is what you want to harvest. So maybe if you end up with too much rhubarb, you can let it flower.
Yes.
I don't know if it gets weedy like asparagus does if the seeds all drop, but.
So far it hasn't. The crown has just slowly started to expand outward just little by little. And so we've had it probably, this will be our third year. Will this be our third year? Might be our fourth year. Oh, it's our third year with it. This will be, so we've already had it 2 years. This will be our third growing season, and it's already a massive plant. You know, I probably could have harvested from it that first year that we put it in the ground, but I didn't. And so it's very similar recommendation with asparagus. You know, don't harvest it that first year that you plant it. Let it develop those leaves. Let it develop that root system. And then also remove those flowers before they develop. But boy, mine really just, it, as soon as it got its roots in the ground, it just went nuts. And so, yeah, we've harvested from it last year, definitely going to harvest from it this year. And yeah, like I said, that crown, that base, that plant's really just sort of slowly been expanding in size. So it'll probably need to be divided maybe soon. And then Ken, I'll bring you some of the divisions here after we divide it.
All right. I think it's able to, like, usually 5 years or so. You divide, mm-hmm. you want to divide that before can starts growing in the spring.
Yeah.
So early in the spring. And then, like you would with a lot of other things, you cut it up and make sure you've got growth points in those individual sections.
Yep. Yep. Make sure you got any mushy spots, you got anything that's suspect in that root cluster, just throw it out, get rid of it. And so I did allude to the, I'm a little bit scared to eat my rhubarb right now. Do you get this question, Ken? People, I mean, I every spring it happens. There's at least, I'd say, like 5 to 10 people call the office and they ask, is it safe to eat my rhubarb? And I don't know, do you experience that?
Yeah, we usually get them, especially, you know, when they really get going and we get a late frost. That's usually when that comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because the rhubarb has emerged so early this year, I'm pretty sure it was up in the first part of March. And, you know, we are definitely not outside of the frost window, at least the normal frost window. And so, like I mentioned, we harvest the stalks from the rhubarb. We don't eat the leaves. That's because the leaves contain oxalic acid, which is not great for our kidneys. And so that kind of gums up our kidneys. And when we get a frost, that oxalic acid moves from the leaves down into those petioles, and because it helps protect it from freezing damage. And so that's why we tell folks, you know, when there's a freeze, just chop off what leaves were exposed to that freeze and let it start over again. Or leave those leaves there and harvest the new stuff that comes up afterwards. And I don't think the oxalic acid is necessarily enough to kill you, but definitely would hurt you. And especially, like, you know, I know my wife's uncle, he had gout, you know, and he would get flare-ups at the drop of the hat. So, I mean, if you have issues with your kidneys like that, you probably don't want to be taking any chances with accidentally eating too much oxalic acid, which they're not going to like that. Your kidneys, at least.
Yeah. If in doubt, say throw it out, but if in doubt, don't harvest.
Yeah. 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 Don't eat it. Rhubarb will throw up more growth. Yeah. Especially if it's good and healthy and established.
Plenty more to come.
So Ken, as we were discussing perennial vegetables, we got on this topic of artichoke, and I think last week we discussed artichoke. You showed us some of your seedlings of artichoke, and the question came up about perennial artichoke, which I didn't even know that was a thing. Describe artichokes as a perennial plant, and Ken, have you done that before?
Yes, my asparagus slash artichoke from last week.
Yeah, there's a little misspeak there. Yeah, yeah.
I had this episode on my mind, even though they look nothing alike. So artichokes are actually perennial vegetables. I think like tomatoes and stuff, I don't know if they're necessarily perennials, but they live a lot longer than they normally would in our gardens. But yeah, so artichokes, like globe artichoke, are perennial. I've usually seen them listed as zone 7, a lot of times zone 8. So they're not going to be hardy for at least central Illinois, maybe down in southern Illinois. You may be able to get them over winter. You probably, if you're going to try to get them over winter, you probably want to provide some protection to those plants. Maybe if you got like a low tunnel or something, some cover over that, help insulate them a little bit, especially if we're going to get real cold. We're getting below zero. Probably would be a good idea to protect those. So they are perennial. I would say for the most part, kind of our northern growers, we're not going to get that perennial plants unless we're doing something special. So what I do is I grow cultivars that are intended for annual production. So they're much quicker to harvest than our perennial types. So the one I grow is Imperial Star. That's 85 days to harvest, whereas Green Globe, which is one of the more common ones, it's a longer season, it's 120 days. So right off the bat, I'm shaving almost 40 days off that harvest by growing these that are bred to that. There's another one called Wonder. That's 88 days to harvest. So with these, you're compressing that growing season. And with artichokes, you still have to get them. You have to get them some cold. So usually it's a week or two of temperatures in the 50s, and that'll stimulate them or trigger them, give them the signal to start flowering. So if you don't get that cold, you may not get much, if any, flower production. So if you're starting them inside and you keep them in until you wait and put them out and we're not getting any more cooler temperatures, you may not get flower production. So right now, started mine early February. So now, if you watched the podcast last week, so they're pretty good size. So now I'm putting them outside because we do keep dropping down into the 20s and stuff. I'm bringing them back in at night a lot of times, but if it's staying in the upper 30s, low 40s, I'm just leaving them out at night. That way they get their cold. I'm drawing a blank on what the term is for that.
All only thing that comes to mind is vernalization.
Vernalization, and there you go. So you get that cold vernalization so I can get that flower production on them. And I think some of these annual ones, the flowers, the artichoke that you're harvesting may not be quite as big as the more perennial types, but you get artichokes a lot easier.
I remember the year I grew artichokes and I did not expose them to cold, and I had some really just pretty foliage plants and no flowers. So yeah, you don't get that cold exposure, you at least still have quasi ornamental plants. Yeah. They don't look too bad in the landscape.
They're another kind of prehistoric, like one of their biggest. So we've tried growing a cardoon last year, which is kind of like artichoke, but you're harvesting those for the leaves and the stalks and stuff. We only got one plant and I never harvested any, so I can't say, but they will get, they're pretty decent size. So if you're going to be growing them, you want to give yourself a little room, and I'll send you some pictures, Chris, and you can pop them up.
Okay.
What they look like. And I think, so last year with the drought or hot weather and dry conditions, we didn't have any success with artichokes, but the year before, we got some. I only harvested a couple. I left a lot just for the flowers to see what they look like. And if you end up with more artichokes than you need, let those flowers bloom. They're very pretty, like a giant thistle, without the problems. So can be very ornamental too. So another be a candidate for that kind of that edible landscaping, in my opinion.
So possibly can be done with perennializing your artichokes. Select the correct type of artichoke for the job. We're kind of at that northern margin of where it would be successful. So maybe invest in some season extension for those really cold nights in the winter.
Yeah, we're probably looking southern Illinois, further south. You're going to be a lot more successful with getting them to perennialize. But with a little work, you may be able to for the north. No guarantee, though. So if you can't, don't get angry at us.
Well, so I think that would be fun to try. But our next one, our perennial vegetable, which we just threw it in there because we're just like, chives. chives, you know, they're there. They don't die. They just keep coming back, doing their thing. We have chives here that are extension office, and they're like the most reliable plant out there. We know they're going to come up. We let them bloom. We very often will get, you know, skippers and other types of butterflies and things like that on the flowers. And so we use them more for ornamental purposes. But yeah, you could go out there any time of the year and just take some scissors and, you know, cut off some chives, spruce up a potato salad. You know, I have nothing about chives except for, yeah, they're chives. They're great. Yeah.
Low maintenance. We've had some in a pot for, I think, about 6-7 years now in our garden. Pot's starting to fall apart because it's been outside for 7 years. But the chives keep going. They've rooted through it into the ground and stuff. So like, even if I wanted to get rid of the pot, I don't know if I could.
They've consumed it.
they got pretty flowers. So that's another one that's got some ornamental appeal and pretty about as low maintenance as you can get, I think.
Oh yeah. Takes a lot of abuse and just doesn't care. Yeah. Well, Ken, this last perennial vegetable we have is one that I would love to grow. I'm just really scared to grow it because it's kind of like asparagus. Once you got it in the ground, it's kind of tough to get rid of it. So horseradish. We did a whole show about horseradish before. We had Dr. Elizabeth Wally on. We talked about this. So we can link to that one below if people want to know the details, the in-depth stuff about horseradish. But this is a root vegetable. You harvest the roots, you leave a little bit of the roots in the ground, and then it will sprout every year. And that's how it stays perennial. But the issue is you can never really get rid of it. Especially if you ever accidentally till that area, you actually wind up spreading those roots in a wider area, and every little chunk of that root is going to sprout, and you're going to have a yard of horseradish. And I like horseradish, but I don't know if I like it that much. So Ken, where should we be planting our horseradish in our gardens?
So I think it's another one, you know, that could soil prep, that good soil. I have read some stuff that can take a little bit of shade, so maybe a little more tolerant than some of our others. But again, full sun, well-drained conditions. And then you're planting those, you plant those like 45-degree angle, remember, right, from that podcast, yeah, with the growth point up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the interest, so, and again, weed control is important, but I think horseradish is a tough enough plant, maybe kind of like chives, where it's like, I don't really care about weeds. I'm still going to grow and probably be able to outcompete at least anything within my root space. So I would say horseradish is one of those that maybe that first year you plant it, you might need to, it might depend upon the size that the plant gets, but you could probably harvest it, but I don't think you would get much from it that first year. So it's probably going to need to wait till that second year you really put on a good mass or size with that root system. And then as you pull that root system out with a potato fork or something, harvest what you want, but then make sure that you replace some of those root pieces back into the soil, cover them back up, and let them keep growing. So that's, you can keep that horseradish going.
Yeah, that's the one we probably won't grow. We don't use that much horseradish to, I don't know what I'd do with a whole bunch of horseradish.
Yeah, I don't know. We do like horseradish on our house, but like you said, I don't think we use it that often. And I think I would just rather have other people prepare it for me, because the preparation process, you know, you have to grate it, which I've heard it's even worse than like onions and stuff, and how it gets into your eyes and makes you cry. So as you grate it, you break those cells. It actually, that's what sort of activates that heat in the horseradish. And you can let that heat build and build and build, but then to stop that heat from building, you have to add vinegar. So that kills that chemical reaction that's happening right there. And so you actually can control the level of heat that you get with your horseradish. So I think that's what I learned from when Elizabeth was on our show that one time. I was like, I didn't know you could like control the heat output from your horseradish simply by just like letting it sit and waiting to add vinegar, which you, again, I like it, but we don't eat that much of it. So yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was all just hot. Maybe I should grow my own.
You forgot about put the vinegar in, didn't you? Oh my goodness. Well, I love it when it's mixed. When you take horseradish, you mix it with like mayonnaise. I like that creamy horseradish sauce, I guess. That's me. Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to do. You can take any like lunch meat sandwich, put a little bit of horseradish on it, a little bit of mayo. Makes it pop. Very good. Put a tomato on there. It's like summer.
But the only time we use it is, well, not even use it, but it's cocktail sauce.
Oh, yeah, that's true. When you're making your Bloody Marys, you mean? Or when you know, eating shrimp or something. Yeah, one of those times. Well, that was a lot of great information about probably some of our more common perennial vegetables, mainly that of like asparagus and rhubarb. That's what a lot of people do grow in their gardens that come back year after year. People, if you want to know more about some of these perennial vegetables, we will link to our Illinois Extension website that covers these different vegetables, plus the podcast where we did with Elizabeth about horseradish. Also, if you grow something that we did not talk about that is a perennial vegetable that comes back year after year, let us know. Maybe we could do a little bit of reading about it and a show about those in the future. Well, the Good Growing Podcast is a production of University of Illinois Extension, edited this week by me, Chris Inroth. A special thank you to Ken Johnson hanging out with me today, chatting about all those vegetables that we put in the ground and come back year after year. Thank you, Ken.
Yes, thank you. We have to... One of these days, I'm going to get the asparagus and rhubarb. I can join the club, man.
I'm bringing them to your house later on this year. I'm make it happen.
All right. And let's do this again next week.
Oh, we shall do this again next week. Have you got bagworms in your trees and shrubs? Well, Ken is going to talk to you all about what to do about them odd little Christmas ornaments that are left hanging around all summer long. Do they hurt? Can you do anything about them? Ken will let you know next week's Garden Bite. So listeners, thank you for doing what you do best, and that is listening, or if you're watching this on YouTube, watching. And as always, keep on growing.